Hello, everyone. My name is Laurie, and I'm an alcoholic. And he also bought me a piece of pie. I figured with the price of gas, I ought to at least offer. Corey has asked me to do a wee bit of explaining here. Circe did acknowledge a wee bit back in 19-whatever, and Addie will know. She's sitting over here now so she can hear better. Addie is Sybil C.'s daughter. Sybil C. was the first sober woman west of the Mississippi back in 1937, I believe. And before she stands up and shoot me, I will explain to those of you who don't know, quote, who I am. In 1937, Sybil was sitting in a Turkish tub trying to get rid of the latest alcohol binge. And she was reading, I thought it was Liberty Magazine, but I understand it was Post. And she saw the Post Magazine article on alcoholism and which eventually brought all of the book sales, or some of them. She wrote a letter to New York saying, I'm desperate. Tell me how to get to New York. Book me a room in this hospital, because there were pictures of the hospital. And help me. I really am. I'm so desperate. A certain amount of time later, Sybil received a letter from a woman named Ruth Hawk, who was Bill Wilson's first secretary. And in this letter, he explained that she explained the real story that there was no hospital, but she had to come to a meeting in Los Angeles. And if you ever get a tape of Sybil's, please listen to it. It's a wonderful story. The reason I explain all of this is the woman that Sybil wrote the story to was my mother, Ruth Hawk. So. And I get goosebumps. Sybil and I re-met. We met in Montreal when our mothers were up on stage. And we met again in San Diego. And we met. We planned to spend some time here together. And we've had a wonderful reunion here. And now, enough of us. I want to introduce you to someone that has become very special to me. I met our next speaker in Montreal. He was up on the stage with my mother when she received the big book. And I have met him and been together with him many times since. We shared the podium in San Diego, and I wanted to see him in Seattle and happened to bump into him in an elevator. I had no idea where he was staying, but I bumped into him in an elevator. Someone was watching over me. And I, as you probably saw up here, got a big hug from him. So without further ado, I want you to please listen to my dear friend, Bob Smith.
I want to thank every one of you for coming here. I think this is great. I'm a friend of Circe's, and I kept getting calls from little groups around Texas wanting me to speak with Circe. And I thought, how do they know my name? Well, I got to tell you a secret. He's been pimping for me. My name is Bob Smith, and I'm an Al-Anon. I got here, I think, like most of us Al-Anons, I love an alcoholic. My wife, who died 2 years ago, was a recovering alcoholic, and she had 19 years in the program when she passed away. And and believe me, folks, for that, I am truly grateful. Not the passing away, but the 19 years. I think to be an Al-Anon that there are some things that I must do. I think I need to live the steps. I think I need to abide by the traditions. I think I need to attend the meetings regularly, and I think I need to have a sponsor. And I do these things. I've been an Al-Anon now for 21 years. My first sponsor was a woman. When I first came into the program, I looked around for a man, and the only guy that was around there at that time was about the age of my son, and I didn't think we had too much going, so I asked this lady, who was even older than I, to be my sponsor. Now, I know we don't recommend sponsors of the opposite sex, but you can tell by looking at me it's not nearly as big an issue. Don't misunderstand me, please. I love to see you beautiful ladies. I just can't remember why. I think part of our organization, AA or Al-Anon, is service. And it seems important to me to tell you that I've been the GR, I've been the DR, I served 3 years with the West Texas Assembly. And several years ago, I got a call from our Al-Anon Central office asking me if I would consider myself to be a candidate for trustee at large for all of Al-Anon. Well, I seem to have the educational qualifications for which they search, and I prayed about it and talked to my group about it, and I called them back, and I said, yes, please consider me to be the candidate for trustee at large for all of Al-Anon. And guess what, folks? I didn't get it. Oh, don't we hate rejection? But the point I want to make with you is, hey, my program came to my rescue like it always will and said, hey, Bob, whoever got that job was capable of doing a much better job than you were. They were going to fit in better, and maybe our Heavenly Father has something else He wants you to do. Free. Totally free of that, and that's what our programs will do for us. Although I am 21 years in Al-Anon, I am somewhat of an anachronism. I'm the only person still living that was present when the two co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous met for the very first time at the home of Henrietta Seiberling, Akron, Ohio, Mother's Day, 1935. My dad's Dr. Bob and my mom's Ann, and I rode out with my parents to meet with Bill for that very first time. My dad had come home the Saturday before Mother's Day with a potted plant. Set it down. He was potted. Went upstairs and passed out. And my mom was a friend of Henrietta Seiberling's, and Henrietta called and said, man, there's a man out here that thinks he can help Bob. Bring him right on up. Well, Mom had to explain to Henrietta that Bob was in no shape to talk to anybody, but she said, I'll get him out there tomorrow. Well, as we rode along, he said, I got one of the worst hangovers I ever had in my life. He said, 15 minutes of this bird is all I want. But it wasn't 15 minutes, folks. He and Bill went off by themselves, and they talked in a room for many hours, and as a result of that meeting, and at my mom's invitation, Bill moved into our home and stayed all that summer. And this is the time that Alcoholics Anonymous started. I think, in my experience in watching it, that it's been a series of miracles. I think that it's important, perhaps, that some of you know that Alcoholics Anonymous started in the middle of the last Great Depression, and Bill and Dr. Bob couldn't have raised 50 bucks between them. But again, I think it was providentially arranged because people had time to talk to each other, and I think that was absolutely essential. We are not as hurried and harried as we are perhaps today, and I think that was a big need. I think I want to tell you about my dad. I think you'd have loved the guy. Dr. Bob was a tall, thin Vermonter, and he had those icy blue eyes that could look right through you, you know. He went along on kind of an even keel, and was a man of not very many words. He was a graduate of Dartmouth, one of the Ivy League colleges, and the Drinker's Ivy League College, and fit right in there. And he prevailed upon his dad, who was the probate judge there in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, to send him out to Chicago to go to medical school. And he busted out of one, but he finally managed to graduate from another and obtained a coveted internship there at City Hospital in Akron. And it was coveted because they had some advanced equipment. So he moved to Akron and married my mom after a whirlwind courtship of only 17 years. Dr. Bob thought things over very carefully. When I brought my bride-to-be home in about 1943, my wife was tall and slender, and I wanted the folks to look her over, you know, before we got married. And Dad looked at her, and he got me aside and said, "She's built for speed and light housekeeping." And I want to tell you a sex and hygiene lecture to me as a teenager. I don't think I'll offend anyone. He got me up in the bathroom one day and closed the door and sat on the edge of the tub. And he said, "Okay, flies spread disease. Keep yours buttoned." Dr. Bob was a very courteous man. Always very polite and courteous. When a woman entered the room, he always stood up. Women felt comfortable around him because he so obviously loved my mom. Also, he loved the slang that the young people used of the day. I'm not talking about the nasty four-letter words, but if Dr. Bob, my dad, were living today, he would be able to talk to you young kids about wording out and stroking and stuff like that. He would understand that. Although he had a fabulous vocabulary. He was a fabulous... Anything he seemed to do, he was good at. He did play bridge with the national champions and things like that. And, of course, Bill was also a tall, thin Vermonter. Bill was raised in East Dorset, my dad in St. Johnsbury, within 100 miles of each other. But these two guys were the total, absolute opposites. My dad went down steady and not much to say, but what he said, he weighed carefully. Bill was the absolute opposite. Bill Wilson, and some of you know him, was garrulous. Bill loved to talk. Bill was a visitor. Bill was a promoter. Bill was a visionary. I think Bill Wilson could see further up the road than any human being I've ever known in my life. And these two guys fit together perfectly. They never had an argument. Amazing, isn't it? I've heard it said that if Alcoholics Anonymous had been left up to Dr. Bob Smith, it'd still be in Ohio. And if Alcoholics Anonymous was left up to Bill Wilson, he'd have sold it to a franchise. But these two guys, I was a teenager at the time, I want you to know this, so I was old enough to kind of understand what was going on. They had two things going for them that I could see. They both had open spiritual minds, and they had the desire to be of service to another human being. And that's it. We lived in a one-industry town, Akron, Ohio. Times were terrible. Rubber shops were down to 2 days a week. There were strong men on the street corner selling apples for 5 cents apiece. We would have been thrown out of our house for non-payment of the mortgage if it hadn't been for the mortgage moratorium declared by President Roosevelt in 1933, which allowed people like us to stay in our home. They hit on the idea together of taking the alcoholics into our home. You know, hospital beds were very expensive in those days. A double is $16. And I think they're up a little now, but nobody had any money. So they would bring the new wet alcoholic in the home. Dad would take him upstairs. And remember, he's the only medical man associated with this movement. And he'd say, now, fella, I'm going to give you a shot of whiskey, but I want you to take this little bit of medicine first. And it was formaldehyde. Now, if any of you have ever smelled formaldehyde, formaldehyde is a very pungent sedative. And if my sister and I, when we came home from high school, when we opened the front door, if we smelled formaldehyde, we knew we'd lost our bed. And he knocked him out from like 24 to 36 hours. It really gave him a jolt. And when the guy sobered up, they brought him downstairs and they started on the diet, you know, to get the nerves settled and get the mind running good again. And they had a standard diet, and I'll tell you about it. It was canned tomatoes, sauerkraut. Yeah, Bill had an ulcer, and he thought sauerkraut cured everything. And Cairo syrup. I think you'll agree the early alcoholics were a hardy group. The first one I remember is a young guy by the name of Eddie R., and Eddie had just been thrown out of his house with a cute little blonde wife and two stair-step kids for non-payment of rent. So they moved the whole family in, took Eddie upstairs and locked him in the upstairs where he'd be available as they got this knowledge. You got to remember, folks, there's nothing written. They're just trying to stay a page ahead of Eddie. So, but Eddie was an agile guy, and we had downspouts. And Eddie would open the second-story window and slide down the downspouts and escape. And they would have to recapture Eddie to continue his... But yeah, one time Eddie got as far away as Cleveland, Ohio, 35 miles. Called him up on the phone, collect, to let them know that he was going to commit suicide. But that he would give them time to drive up and witness the event. Well, when they brought Eddie back home again, and Eddie got sobered up, he had a mental problem that hadn't surfaced. And he began beating up on this little, cute little blonde lady to whom he was married. And then he began chasing my mom around the house with a butcher knife. So we held a group conscience meeting. And it was decided the only thing that they could do with Eddie was for his little wife to take him back to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and recommit him in a mental institution, and this was done. And Bill and Dad were crestfallen. Here's the first attempt to sober up another alcoholic. Total failure. But I want to tell you folks something. At my dad's funeral 15 years later, a guy walked up to me and he said, do you know me? And I looked at him and I said, yeah, I know you. You're Eddie. And he said, that's right. And he said, I want you to know I'm a member of the Youngstown, Ohio AA group, and I've been sober 1 year. Yeah. Yeah. So we never know the result of that 12-step call, do we? We're only called on to take that hand that reaches out for help. I think the results depend upon perhaps the zeal of the person receiving the message and our heavenly, the will of our Heavenly Father. But we do not know, and thank God we don't have to be fully qualified when we go to make a 12-step call. We go with what we have, right? And that's what it takes. That's all that's required of us, to take that hand that reaches out for help. Alcoholics Anonymous was not just a huge success to start with. It was thought of as a cult and a bunch of nuts. Yeah, we got kicked out of the Presbyterian Church on account of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never heard of anybody getting kicked out of the Presbyterian Church. But the minister said that they were disturbing the congregation. It wasn't an easy thing. It was just a bare trickle. We were not popular with the neighbors. If you'd like to get a feel for that, start a halfway house in your home. But fortunately, these two guys persevered. You know, Bill was also a tall, thin Vermonter. Yeah, and Dan was a tall, thin Vermonter. But the person I want to talk to you about is someone nobody seems to know much about, and that's my mom. Remember, my mom is the one that said, Bill, come live with us. That has to be a miracle. She didn't say, come over, we're going to have soup next Tuesday. She said, Bill, come and live with us. Miracle. Now, remember, Bill lived in New York City, and we lived in Akron, Ohio, and I'll tell you another miracle. Bill said, okay. A mom wrote to Lois, our beloved Al-Anon co-founder, and Lois came down and stayed as long as she could that summer. But then she had to get back to New York City. You've got to remember, Lois was the only one that had a job. But it was the start of a friendship that we kept going until Lois died in recent years. Mom was a graduate of Wellesley, one of the fine women's colleges in the East, and she went there on a scholarship. She was had a fine mind. Her great uncle was the president of the Santa Fe Railroad. In those days, the president of the railroad had his own private car, and it was very opulent, and they could tie on trains wherever trains went. And he liked my mom, so she used to, he would invite her, and she would ride around the country with him. So she kind of got to see the genteel side of life. Mom was a school teacher. She'd led a very sheltered and protected life and was very easily shocked until AA. Okay, you got to remember that this is the lady that made the beds. This is the lady that cooked the food. This is the lady that cleaned up the messes. This is the lady that answered the telephone calls for 12-step requests and family calling in to ask about their loved ones. And Bill himself said Ann Smith is the mother of AA, and I truly believe that. I would like, if I may, to excerpt a letter that Bill sent that Henrietta Dodson, the wife of AA number 3, sent to Bill. Now, Henrietta's husband was the AA number 3, the attorney on the bed, the southern attorney. And so his wife is writing this letter to Bill. On Friday, June 28, 1935, I met Ann Smith. I met Dr. Bob on Thursday evening in the hospital. On Thursday evening when I went to the hospital to see my husband, Dr. Bob was there, and he said the little woman would like you to come over to the house. I told him I couldn't go that night, but would go the next night. On Friday night when I went to the house on Ardmore Avenue, and that's our homestead address, I met the most thoughtful, understanding person I have ever known. After talking with her for a while, I addressed her as Mrs. Smith, and she said, Ann, to you, my dear. She wanted to remove all the barriers. And I skip a little bit. Ann told me to surrender myself to God and not to try and see if he had a plan for me to reveal it to me. Ann taught me to have a quiet time in the morning that I might feel near to God and receive strength for the day. She taught me to surrender my husband to God and not to try and tell him how to stay sober, as I had tried that and failed. And I skip a little bit. Ann taught me to love everyone. She said, ask yourself what is wrong with me today if I don't love you. She said the love of God is triangular from God, through me, through you, and back to God. She taught me that I should never criticize the remarks of the person leading meetings, as we do not know God's plan. Maybe what that person says will meet the need of someone in the group. In the early part of 1936, Ann organized a women's group for wives of alcoholics, whereby in her loving way she tried to teach us patience, love, and unselfishness. And I skip a little bit. When I met and talked with this intelligent, deeply spiritual woman, I was completely sold on A.A. Henrietta Dodson. So you see, Mom realized right from the word go it was an illness that affected the whole family. And when Lois decided to see if there was any interest in a program like our Al-Anon program, she wrote to all the AA groups around the country to see if there was any interest. And to her surprise, she found out there were 64 groups already doing it. Yeah, independent thinking. They had figured it out, and they were doing something about it. So Mom was wise enough to see that the need was there. And, of course, Lois and Ann B. met that need and became our program. You know, my dad was 15 years older than Bill, and so he only lived for 15 years. In that length of time, he personally treated, without charge, medically and AA-wise, over 5,000 alcoholics, which is really an amazing feat. And Mom never lost faith in these two guys. Mom took up smoking when she was 50. I said, Mom, you're not going to start smoking now, are you? She said, if you wait till you're 50, I won't say anything. And as an economy move, Mom bought a Target machine to roll your own cigarettes. Any of you ever seen one? You know, you put the paper there and sprinkle the tobacco, and then it has a lever, and you roll it over, and it rolls a cigarette. Well, my sister and I had been swiping her cigarettes, and we really thought this was a little bit lower than our dignity. So we rolled her some, a whole pack. Instead of tobacco, though, we used the shavings out of the pencil sharpener. And, of course, when she lit it, the fire didn't go out. And after about two of those, she said, you know, these don't taste nearly as good as those Lucky Strikes. All the early meetings were open. Mom sat in the back of the room, and she always wore the same old black dress. Greeted everyone that came in. And when Dad got on his feet financially, Mom ended up with three brand new dresses, and someone said, Ann, are you going to wear none of the new dresses to the meeting tonight? And she said, no. I'm going to wear the old black dress. There'll be somebody come through those doors that can't afford a new dress. And that's the way this beautiful woman was. I want to talk to you about recovery. I think that that is the thing that I like to hear when I go to a meeting. Let's hear about recovery. How'd they do it? What worked? What didn't work? I'm going on the basic assumption that everyone in this room already knows how to be miserable. Bill in New York and my dad and Mom in Akron, Ohio, belonged to a group called the Oxford Group, and it was started by a Lutheran minister from Pennsylvania by the name of Frank Buckman, and the basic tenets of that program were back to first century spirituality. And Searcy touched on it. They had four: absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity of thought, and absolute love. They had meetings. They shared with each other. They kept track of each other. They tried to, and they introduced a bunch of things that fit very well into our program. And they had a form of a confession. They used to take a new guy upstairs and bore in on him until he admitted what his problem was. Well, you see, that form was not acceptable to people of the Catholic faith. Open confession. And I don't know whether you people realize it or not, but there are Catholics that drink. That and the fact the Oxford group catered to the upper middle class, and believe you me, the early alcoholics were not upper middle class. The Oxford group wanted publicity, and the alcoholics already had all the publicity they wanted. So it was inevitable that they part, but this was, we owe those people a tremendous debt of gratitude. And another thing they used was God's Faithbook. 13th Corinthians, the Sermon on the Mount, and as all of you know, the book of James, faith without works is dead. This was the basic stuff that they had to work with. This is the stuff that they've melded together, the first 100 people to form the programs as we know them today. Betty and I attended the first international in 1950. in Cleveland, Ohio. My dad was terminally ill, and he gave a brief talk. But this is the one where they accepted the traditions. And this is so, you know, I'm convinced that these traditions are the glue that holds us together. You know, in 1942 to 45, AA started to self-destruct. There were people hanging out their shingle as AA's official representative. They were incorporating it in different states. There were hospitals, the official AA hospital. And it was decided that we were going to be like the Washingtonians, just blow apart. So they wrote the traditions, and at that first international, they accepted them. Betty and I drove my dad back to his beloved Vermont one more time, and I wouldn't take for the caring and sharing that we had. And then I had to get back to Dallas. I had a flying job out of Dallas at the time, and I had to get back to work, and I never saw my dad alive again. In 1955, Betty and I attended, Bill invited us to attend the second international in St. Louis. And this is the one where the spiritual people who had loved AA when AA wasn't cool gave talks. You know, Dr. Sam Shoemaker from New York and Father Ed Dowling from St. Louis. And those talks are recorded in a chapter, Religion Looks at AA, in the book AA Comes of Age, if any of you are interested. These were giants, giant people. Well, Betty and I were party animals. We liked to drink and we liked to dance, and we went merrily on our way. Now, Betty had poured her dad into a drying out place in Denver in 1944, and he and another guy started Alcoholics Anonymous in New Mexico. So if there was any two people that should have recognized alcoholism, it was my wife and me. But we didn't. We were different. It wasn't going to happen to us. And as we met merrily our way, and I damn sure wasn't telling anybody my dad was the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, I think alcoholism is maybe divided into three sections. Fun and problems, problems. And when it got over into the problem area, we didn't say, oh, boy, this is our opportunity. We could join AA and Al-Anon. This is our life's ambition. No, we didn't. We began to try and gussy it up a little bit, and I like to describe it this way. Two hunters loved to hunt up in the northern woods of Alaska. And so they would hire a little aviation company to fly them into a lake and then leave them for a week and then come pick them up again. So sure enough, the little aviation company plane came in, and the hunter said, oh, one of them said, gee, we're glad to see you. We had a wonderful hunt. We got four moose. And the pilot said, four moose? You two guys and me in this little plane? One of the hunters said, oh, don't worry about it. He said, a man came in last year with a plane just exactly like yours. We have four moose. And he said what he did was he taxied up the river and got a better run for takeoff, and he got off no problem. So the pilot thought, well, I'm new with the company. I've got to try this. So anyway, he took off, and sure enough, they head back towards civilization. But the little engine is working so hard, it begins to overheat and then loses power. And way out in the middle of nothing, they crash. And one of the hunters pulls his buddy out from under the plane and dusts him off, and his buddy looked around and said, where in the world are we? And the other said, you know, I think we're within 100 yards of where we crashed last year. And that's the way our life was going, trying the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Well, when it finally got bad enough, my mother-in-law said to me, why don't you tell her you want a divorce? That'll shock her. I thought, that's a great idea. So I did. And boy, was I disappointed. It didn't shock her near as much as I thought it ought to. What had happened was the alcohol had taken the number one priority, and the family had moved down. But anyway, it got bad enough, she finally went to AA herself. Hanging on by her fingernails, she said, I don't recommend it that way, but I'll tell you one thing, you'll never forget it. So she was running off and leaving me. I could see that. It was really a program of attraction for me. So somebody said to me, well, why don't you go to Al-Anon? And I thought, well, why not? I don't mind joining your auxiliary. So I got in my car and I drove 40 miles over to Gainesville, Texas, and I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting, and I look around and I'm the only guy. Room full of women. Well, I immediately got mixed emotions about Al-Anon. And I like to describe mixed emotions this way. It's kind of like the feeling you get when your teenage daughter comes in at 4 in the morning with a Gideon Bible under her arm. But I stayed, and I had laid a trip on those gals. Oh, Lord, I was noble. You know, the rock had been holding the family together. And they listened very patiently. And I left that meeting knowing I had made a wonderful impression on them. But you know, these things are revealed to us as we can handle them. I talked to Ann, one of the ladies that was there a couple of years afterwards. She said, oh, I remember that meeting. Bob said, after you left, we held a meeting. And we said, boy, there's one that's not going to make it. We had to peel away the past. We had a lot of anger on both sides that we had to work through, which sometimes involved just walking off and leaving the other one. Anything to avoid an argument, you may be right, all those things that we had to go through that fortunately our programs teach us how to do it. I think that the change that we have to make in order to accept these programs is slow and hard and difficult, but once we do it, it is so worthwhile. Anyway, we're getting along pretty good. You know, Betty's going down her AA path, and I'm going down the Al-Anon path. Everything is going smooth. The dog has died. The kids are all out of school. You know, we were pretty free, and we were prospering. We live in a little country town called Nocona, Texas, and I can tell it's not a household word with you. But we were doing so well that we decided that we put carpeting in our bathroom. And you know how good that feels on your feet on the cold winter mornings? And we liked it so well, we ran it on into the house. The phone rang. It was a telephone call and said, your son has just killed himself. Scott had no problem with alcohol or drugs. He was a member of Mensa, had a master's degree cum laude with the University of Texas. Gone to work one day, he was top BMW salesman in Dallas, and the corporate stress had got him. He walked out in his car, sat down, pulled out his gun, and blew his brains out. Well, you know, no parent wants to outlive their kids. But the point I want to tell you is that the groups, both programs, gathered around us and propped us up until we could stand by ourselves. And then 6 months later, my beautiful wife, to whom I'd been married 53 years, came down with lung cancer. And she passed away in another 12 months. And again, you people gathered me together, propped me up, held me until I could stand by myself. I tell you this because I think that this is part of life on life's terms. If you live long enough, these things are going to happen to you. But the beautiful part is if you stay with your program and continue to help others, when that time comes, you will get the help you need. And another thing that I think happens is every meeting you go to, every convention you attend, you build a little bit of reserve strength in the bank, if you will, that you can call on when times get so terribly, terribly difficult. I stay because you are my friends. I stay because if I can show you me just like I am, warts and all, total honesty, I'm not talking about cash register honesty, I'm not talking about resume honesty, I'm talking about total honesty, and you do the same for me, we can have an instant, intimate relationship. And I know of no other organizations in the world that you can do this. If you're new here, remember AA started from absolutely nothing. If you're new here, remember that this program has been a series of miracles. Can you imagine what it looks like in my eyes, knowing it started with two guys, and what it is today? In my lifetime, I know that this had the help of a loving God. I am firmly convinced of that. So you have that help available to you also. Please call on us. Please talk to us. Because you don't bother us. You help us. The famous humanist, Dr. Albert Schweitzer, said this, and I'll close with this. He said, I know not what your destiny may be, but this one thing I do know, that those among you who will find true happiness are those who have sought and found how to serve. And isn't that where our happiness comes? Helping someone else. Thank you very much.